Commissioner Brennan? Brennan?
I see him.
I'd say present, but I'm not really sure. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Commissioner Gurney? Commissioner McClure?
Here.
Commissioner Stone?
Here.
Commissioner Novell?
Here.
Commissioner Zimmer?
Here.
Chair Schellenberger?
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you very much. And if staff would like to take us through any changes to the agenda today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's just one change on page 11 of the agenda, item 17A, which is the Del Norte County LCP amendment for Hogberg. That item's been postponed. And I'll also take this opportunity to just address folks in the audience that if you'd like to speak to the commission today, you'll need to fill out a speaker slip, which is available on the table at the end of the hallway. Please fill that out and give it to staff. The table also contains some addenda items for today's agenda and a binder with previously published staff reports. And I'd also like to ask people to please turn off your cell phones or put them on a silent mode so it doesn't disrupt the meeting. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, just one adjustment. We'd like to trail the public access program to after the legal briefing. So we would do the legal briefing right after public comment.
Okay. And Ms. Schmelter, did you want to talk about a public comment in relation to the field trip?
Yes, thank you. Any comment that members of the public may have about items on the field trip should be done during the public comment period now. There won't be an opportunity on the field trip for practical reasons to comment on the different locations on the field trip. So if members of the public would like to speak about any of the locations the commission will be visiting, now would be the time to do it.
Great. Thank you very much. Marcia Hanscom, then Athena Schleen, and then Dorothy Krause. And if you all could come forward and be ready to take the mic, that'd be great. Good morning.
Marcia Hanscom, good morning, honorable commissioners. And I just want to ask you to keep an open mind in spite of what your staff told you, that there is nothing you can do about Malibu Lagoon. There are conditions that you required that must be met, and there are conditions of other permits and CEQA that must be met. With that, I'd like to show this almost three-minute video for those of you who didn't see it when this was passed. Many of you are new to the commission.
Here's an alternative seven-step plan for genuine restoration of Malibu Lagoon. Remove inappropriate plants like this spurge by hand with community groups and volunteers. These are non-natives that do not provide shelter or food for wildlife and are toxic to the soils. Along the walking trails, plant local native wetland, transition, and upland plants. Create and install educational graphics and signage like this. On the former parking lot and grassy lawn, plant shallow water wetland, transition, and upland plants. Here at Malibu Lagoon, in this small patch of a wetland meadow is an ideal place to put two endangered species of plants close to extinction that like to associate with this yellow-flowered salt marsh daisy. And those two endangered plants are the Ventura marsh milkfetch and the salt marsh bird's beak.
Thank you. Athena? And I'm sorry.
Okay. Nobody gets it. It's Schlein. My name is Athena Schlein.
Thank you.
I wore tall shoes, so I didn't have to stand on my toes to reach the microphone today. It's a beautiful day, and I'm so happy to share Malibu Lagoon with you. As I drove past, I saw many, many birds circling above the lagoon. Last week, I spoke with Richard Bloom about the lagoon, and he was there not too long ago, but he said he did not look. So I'm asking each and every one of you to please look at the lagoon. There have been several reasons given for the bulldozing of Malibu Lagoon. I'm going to just go through the justifications. Mark Gold said to a small group of people at Point Doom that the Malibu Lagoon was so polluted it violated the Clean Water Act. If they didn't do something, that the EPA would step in. Clark Stevens of the Resource Conservation District of the Santa Monica Mountains said, the lagoon is sick. It has a disease. Shelley Luce, Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission scientist, said the lagoon is dying. And recently, Suzanne Good has admitted that the lagoon project will not address the pollution in the lagoon. It, in fact, has nothing to do with the fecal matter in the lagoon, and it is simply to address the topography of the lagoon. Now, I believe surfing there for 8 years, I would recognize a polluted lagoon. The animals have an inherent knowledge. Basically, they will go where there is good water and good food, and they have been thriving there for many years. We have many scientists that have offered their expert opinions that have not been taken up on that. One of them is Dr. Hartmut Walter, professor emeritus at UCLA, an ornithology and geography consultant for wetland habitats in many countries. Another is Kathleen Bullard. She's former executive director of the Resource Conservation District of the Santa Monica Mountains and overseer of the Tidewater Gobi reintroduction. And there's Vladimir and Irene Kosho. He's a UCLA research physiologist. So when we walk through the lagoon, please just keep in mind that there are alternatives, and it's not too late because the bulldozers have not started yet. So I think that you have a chance to really make friends with the public people, and this is public land, and we want something beautiful and positive out of this, and I believe that we could heal our relationship. There's such a separation between agencies and people. And the very formation of these agencies were to serve the people. So please, let's bring that back. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dorothy Krause.
My name is Dorothy Krause, and I'm from Newport Beach. And I'm going to talk about the unpermitted mowing being conducted by the city of Newport Beach on Sunset Ridge. Sunset Ridge is a parcel of property owned by the city of Newport Beach, planned to become a park. When Newport Beach acquired the property from Caltrans in 2006, it appears the city initially mowed only 100 feet from structures consistent with the city's fire code. This is an aerial photo taken in 2007 where you can see the 100-foot buffer clearly from the nearest structures, which is Newport Crest. Here in an email from spring of 2009 obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, the city's park supervisor tells the city's assistant engineer that the mowing is occurring 100 feet from structures as directed by the fire department. But that year, mowing included the entire property, not just the 100-foot buffer around structures. This included areas of encelia that the Coastal Commission staff biologist ultimately concluded would rise to the level of Esha if left undisturbed. This is a photograph of mowed encelia on Sunset Ridge taken in November of 2009. And it was not just mowing, but the application of herbicide as well. This is a job proposal memo from the landscape maintenance company, and the last paragraph reads, apply one spraying of general herbicide to both the lower and upper flat areas within the park. And the reason given on the payment authorization to this maintenance company is for park development clearing rather than fire safety. The following year, there was again seemed to be some confusion within the city hall about how much to mow. In this email between fire department officials obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, once again, it is clear that the city ultimately wants the entire site mowed. Vague references to the Coastal Commission are made. This next slide is the same email message. Again, it references the Coastal Commission, but no further details are provided. In summary, for fire safety reasons, mowing should be performed 100 feet from structures, but there is no need to mow areas of Encelia that are up to 570 feet away from structures, yet the city continues mowing all of Sunset Ridge. This is a vegetation map showing the extent of Encelia, which are the orange cross hatch area, which is currently being mowed without a coastal development permit. This excessive mowing occurs without a coastal development permit needs to be stopped. I respectfully encourage the Coastal Commission to begin enforcement action against the City of Newport Beach on this matter. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Suzanne Forrester, then Kevin Nelson, and Steve Dunn. If you all would move forward, I'd appreciate it. Suzanne Forrester.
My name is Suzanne Forrester. I live on the perimeter of Banning Ranch in Newport Beach, and I'm going to talk about the mowing that I've observed and documented on Banning Ranch over the last 2 years. Here is a satellite map of Banning Ranch. The red area on the map is the upland mesa, and I have pictures that document the mowing in that area over a three-day period in July of 2011. The green area is the 100-foot buffer zone that is required for fire prevention. It borders the perimeter of the Newport Crest condominiums. On July 7th, 2011, the upland mesa, that's the red area, was mowed for 5 hours. On July 8th, it was mowed for 2 hours. All of the mowing was outside the 100-foot buffer zone. This is the second satellite map, the red area, which is on the upland mesa, and this is adjacent to the arroyo, was mowed for 2 hours on July 11th, 2011. Clearly, again, outside any buffer zones. This is a picture taken from the back deck of my residence. At least once a year, the buffer zone at the wall perimeter of Newport Crest is rototilled for fire prevention. That's what you see here. This isn't mowing, this is rototilling. The pictures I'm about to show you bear no resemblance to this method of fire prevention. They show a tractor mower going around in circles literally for hours on the upland mesa. This is the Longview Upland Mesa West. You can see the administration buildings to the far left. The tractor mower is to the far right, and the yellow post is, I'm using that as a point of reference for these slides. This is the Longview of the Upland Mesa East. You can see the tractor mower circling around the yellow post in the ground, well outside the 100-foot buffer zone. Again, the Longview Upland Mesa East. Here we have the tractor mower still circling the yellow post, well outside of any buffer zone. This went on for 5 hours on July 7th, 2 hours on July 8th, and again on July 10th. Here's a near view of the Upland Mesa, again circling the yellow post, well outside of any buffer zone. There's another near view. Here the tractor continues to circle the post. This is to the east, still well outside any buffer zones. Here you see the dust and exhaust fumes. And there's always dust while this is going on because apparently they're mowing right down to the dirt. Here's a mid-view. Again, you can see the dust clouds to the right. So in closing, my questions are these. What are they mowing and why are they mowing it? How much critical habitat has already been destroyed by this kind of mowing? And how will we ever know what could grow on this land, whether it be Encelia that could lead to Esha or something else, if they're mowing it down to the dirt and not allowing anything to grow? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Kevin Nelson.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Kevin Nelson. I'll also be showing you some information on the destruction of habitat on Banning Ranch. All right. So here's a here's an example of some of the density of the habitat, Escher cactus, Insulia, large arroyo right there. These the examples I'm going to show you are habitat destruction that have been ongoing in small but very detailed ways for years. So this is the Banning Ranch DEIR that the city is beginning to process. This area that the air is pointing to is listed as disturbed on the DEIR. This is the area you'll see around that cactus patch that is dense in cilia. This is that same area when it was originally disturbed. You can see how cleanly it was mowed. Perhaps one of the reasons it was disturbed originally is that there the bluff road is planned directly to come directly to the right of that cactus patch. This is another area listed as grasslands where that arrow is pointing there. This is that same area, fully filled in by Insulia, and there's cactus off to the right. This is that same exact area mowed as it has been multiple times, occasionally in the middle of winter. Here we have another area listed as grasslands. We have a vernal pool in this area that was very large and extensive vernal pool for a long period of time. Here's the resultant vegetation from that pool, and nothing left. Now, that was cleaned by a crew of guys with machetes, not just mowed by the machinery. Here we have a patch of cactus on the mesa that Suzanne was talking about. Gone. Manually. Here we have, this area was dense in cilia. Gnatcatchers have been sighted in this general vicinity. A little bit larger area. The cilia broken up. Now it's, of course, area is listed as disturbed. All right, so now I'll show just a couple of other smaller examples. This has been ongoing. Here is the general areas that have been affected in this way by this ongoing campaign to destroy the habitat that will then be presented to you as disturbed in the reports by the developer. This is very extensive. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve Dunn? Is Steve here? John Davies?
John Davis speaking. Honorable Chair and distinguished commissioners, in regard to your actions on item 11B and 12A on the November 3rd, 2011 meeting, the commission actions were substantially different than those recommended in the staff report. The commission stated the basis for their action in sufficient detail to allow staff to prepare a revised findings staff report with proposed revised findings that reflected the actions of the commission. The names of the commissioners entitled to vote pursuant to Public Resources Code Section 30315.1 were recorded within the minutes. On November 29, 2011, I transmitted a letter to the Coastal Commission to inquire as to when the legally required revised findings would be presented to the Coastal Commission. I hereby request this commission instruct its staff to prepare the revised findings. On January 6th of this year, Executive Director Charles Lester responded that revised findings would not be necessary. The Commission clearly articulated substantial changes in sufficient detail to allow staff to prepare reflective changes and present them in revised findings. The Coastal Commission staff is refusing to prepare revised findings pursuant to California Code of Regulations Section 13906. The executive director thereby announced that staff would violate the Public Resource Code Section 13906, resulting in subsequent violations of the Public Resource Code Sections 30604 and 21000, which require the written conclusions about the consistency of the application of the following and findings of fact, reasoning supporting the decision. Contrary to the law, Public Resources Code 13077 sub C, staff proposes not to include all of the elements identified in Section 13057 Section C of the Public Resource Code. Staff infers the commission did not state the basis for changes in sufficient detail to allow staff to make such changes. Please request the staff to prepare the revised findings in conformance with California Code of Regulations Section 13096 and Public Resource Code 2100-3064, 13057C, and 30315.1. And this is extra important because the staff is conflicted in that it has advised the County of Los Angeles co-applicant for permits as to how to bring their permits into conformance with the Coastal Act when they shall not do that according to the Public Resources Code. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just want to observe that we did look at this question and we will be preparing written findings according to the law, and that would happen in the next couple of months. We didn't find it necessary, given the details of that action, to have revised findings come back to the commission, but there will be adopted findings.
Thank you. Kathy Knight.
Good morning. My name is Kathy Knight, and I'm with the Biona Ecosystem Education Project, and we support what John Davis has asked for, revised findings being brought to the commission. There were some major changes being made in the Marina Del Rey LCP. And also, I really want to emphasize that the commission, please hold meetings that are so important like that in the local county, at least in the local county. We had to drive down from here to San Diego to speak for 2 or 3 minutes. And most of the people, there was a huge turnout on the subject matter several years ago when it was held locally. A lot of people care about Marina Del Rey, have a lot of feelings about Marina Del Rey, you know, staying not so completely overdeveloped like Wilshire Boulevard along the coast. A lot of people have a lot of feelings about that and you know, really are interested in being involved, but we had to rent a car to drive down there because our cars, you know, probably wouldn't make it. So we rented a car, drove 90 miles to speak for 2 or 3 minutes, and not many of us could do it. The leaseholder, developers, and all of those people, they could stay in hotels down there. They had a big luxury bus people in. We wanted to have a bus, and we couldn't afford a bus. So this whole thing is so skewed towards the leaseholders and the people with the money to come and be there at the hearings and turn out. And I think it should be a requirement that it be in at least the local county of the issue, especially on something like this where you know there's a lot of interest. Let's see. And basically, I really appreciate everyone who's talked here today. I hear the citizens, they don't have a profit motive. They're not going to make money off of this. Like Marina Del Rey is a cash cow for the leaseholders in the county. But the people hearing today, they just care about our planet, our coast, nature, and preserving something for future generations. And I really appreciate that motive that I'm hearing today. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve Dunn. Is Steve here? All right. That will conclude our public comment period, and we'll go back to staff.
Are you ready? So I think we're going to move to the legal briefing now and trail item 5 and do item 5.3. And that would be Ms. Schmelzer will present that. From time to time, we do briefings on various issues of concern both to you and to the public about how the process works and issues that need to be kept in the front of our minds, and that's what we're doing here today. It's been several years since we had a briefing on some of these issues about public participation in ex parte communications, and so we thought it would be timely to do that since we haven't done that in a couple of years, or at least.
Good morning. I'm here today to talk about the way the public participates in Coastal Commission meetings and actions, including ex parte communications. And just by way of introduction, first of all, I'd like to say that the artwork you see on this slide was all submitted by kids around the state as part of our public education contest, and I don't see why they should be the only ones who get to use the fun stuff. So everyone can look at some of the great art the kids around the state do about the coast. But first, a couple of things about public participation. All of you commissioners, received information about these topics and the statutes that govern them when you were first appointed to the commission, along with literally stacks of information about other rules and commission procedures. For those of you who've been here a long time, we always think it's good to review this information from time to time. And for those of you who were appointed over the last year, now that you've had some time to get your coastal legs and figure out how all the different pieces of the commission fit together, and I know you've all figured that all out, it's a good time to make sure the information is understood. It's also beneficial for the public to review this information so that the public has a better understanding of how and why the rules operate. To begin with, I first want to introduce the idea of due process and public participation. It's important to understand that the vast majority of your actions at these hearings constitute quasi-judicial or quasi-adjudicative actions, which means that you are acting much like a court adjudicating a matter that comes before it. You are holding a hearing, listening to a presentation of facts, and applying the Coastal Act, LCP policies and ordinances, and regulations to come to a decision. Thus, the law is clear that the constitutional guarantee of due process, which includes basic fairness principles, applies to your hearings just as it does in a court of law. We're going to come back to due process periodically during this presentation as we discuss public participation and ex parte communications. Public participation in Coastal Commission meetings and decisions happen under two statutes. The Bagley-Keene Open Meeting Act, which applies to meetings of all state bodies such as boards and commissions, and the Coastal Act, which obviously only applies to you. Both of these statutes have rules and requirements and carry potential monetary penalties to the person who violates those. In many cases, violation of these statutes could result in the voiding or overturning of a Coastal Commission decision. Ensuring that decisions are arrived at under the correct rules and are thus safe from challenge, at least on process grounds, is one of the goals of your legal staff at these meetings. Public participation under the Coastal Act was guaranteed by the legislature, and there were various legislative findings. Back one. No, we're not going back. Can you go back a slide or two?
This one's not working backwards.
Thank you. The legislature found and wrote into the Coastal Act that the public has a right to fully participate in decisions affecting coastal planning, conservation, and development, that achieving sound coastal conservation and development is dependent upon public understanding and support, and that the process should include the widest opportunity for public participation. Further, in the Coastal Act, now we can go forward. No, we're back too far again. Anyway, ensure adequate participation by all interested groups and the public at large. Advise the public as to effective ways of participating in Coastal Commission proceedings. And public participation enables the Commission to recommend to other agencies additional measures to assure more effective public participation in programs. So we seek to maximize public participation at our public meetings. One of the ways all state agencies ensure that the public can be knowledgeable about their processes and decisions is by following the Bagley-Keene Open Meeting Act. As it sounds, the Open Meeting Act was passed with the intent of having government decision-making bodies conduct their meeting in public and not behind closed doors. The law ensures that the public is given 10-day notice of the time and place of the meeting and that the public has an opportunity to watch, observe, and participate in the process. I'm not going to go through all of the details of the statute, which would take a long time, but rather focus on a couple of major points. What is a meeting? This is one of the most basic questions, but it's a bit more complicated than it seems. The definition of the statute is found in the Bagley-Keene Act at 11122.5A, and states, as you can read on the slide, a meeting includes any congregation of a majority of the members of a state body at the same time and place to hear, discuss, or deliberate upon any item that is within the subject matter of the state body to which it pertains. So this can include items for voting or items for discussion. Excellent. And the definition then goes on to state, and this is where it can become more complicated, that a majority of the members of a state body shall not, outside of a meeting authorized by this chapter, use a series of communications of any kind, directly or through intermediaries, to discuss, deliberate, or take action on an item or business that is within the subject matter of the body. This is the provision that bars what are known as serial meetings. And the point is, any time a meeting occurs, it must occur in a properly and publicly noticed meeting open to the public. And a meeting can still occur even if a majority of the commissioners are not present in one room or in one phone call. An example of a serial meeting would be a submajority or quorum of commissioners discussing an item within the commission's jurisdiction, and then one or more of the commissioners speaking to enough other commissioners to constitute a majority. A serial meeting can occur even without members of the commission realizing that they are participating in one. For example, if one of the members of the commission does not speak to any other members, but the second member does, the first member would have no knowledge that a serial meeting was then occurring. But particularly if some conclusion is reached amongst commissioners outside of the public eye, that would constitute a serial meeting. Intermediaries, too, could conduct serial meetings. People conducting ex partes or other meetings with you, raising the same topic with multiple commissioners and seeking to reach an agreement amongst commissioners can constitute a serial meeting. So a best practice would be not to discuss substantive commission business with other commissioners outside of a publicly noticed meeting. And in addition, when conducting ex parte communications, to gather information but not to reach conclusions. A subcommittee. From time to time, the commission convenes subcommittees. Subcommittee meetings are not public meetings. They are, by definition, less than a majority of the commissioners. And technically, a subcommittee may be any number of commissioners that are less than a majority. But for reasons both legal and practical, this commission has limited its subcommittees to 2 to 3 members. On a legal level, limiting the members on a subcommittee provides protections from inadvertently convening a serial meeting. For example, a majority of this body is 7 members. Should a subcommittee be convened that had 6 people, all it would take is one commissioner inadvertently discussing a topic with one non-subcommittee commissioners for a serial meeting to potentially have occurred. And from a practical perspective, larger subcommittees are just more difficult to schedule. Public notice and participation. Under Bagley-Keene, the commission must give at least... Public notice and participation. Under Bagley-Keene, the commission must give at least 10 days public notice of a commission meeting, including the time, date, and location of the meeting, as well as a brief description of the items to be discussed or acted on at the meeting, including whether those items are for discussion or action. So sometimes an agendized item will bring up a different topic, and you may be interested in discussing that topic. But when this happens, we try and note that it must be agendized for a future meeting, and at that point, have the item on the commission agenda with a brief description. In addition, while items may come off of an agenda within the 10-day period, they cannot be added once the meeting is within 10 days of the noticed agenda. Public participation. The Bagley-Keene Act ensures that the public may speak before or during each item on the agenda, as well as on matters not on the agenda, and submit written materials. As you have seen, the commission strictly follows this mandate by having comment periods for each item, as well as a comment period for matters not on the agenda, and by collecting and distributing written or electronic materials. The commission's process also embodies the Coastal Act mandate to provide for maximum public participation. The commission may adopt reasonable and fair rules to govern these comment periods, such as limiting the time members of the public may speak for, so long as the rules apply equally to all viewpoints on a matter. And you will note that your chair and vice chair assign the same amount of public comment time to each member on a matter, to each member of the public on a matter. In addition, you also see this principle in play when the commission completes the public testimony portion of the hearing and deliberates. And the reason the commission doesn't allow one interested party or another to continue to testify at will during commissioner deliberations is the right to ensure the due process of all the interested parties. The comments made by the public become part of the record on an item, and the commissioners may use information presented during the public comment as part of its substantial evidence in making decisions. This, however, brings us to the one entitlement of the public to participation that is not open and occurring in public, ex parte communications. The direct Latin translation of ex parte is buyer for one party. The phrase is used in law to refer to proceedings or communications that are brought by one person in the absence of another, which obviously does raise issues of fairness, and it's these sorts of fairness concerns that the Commission's rules are designed to address. The Commission owes a duty to the parties that come before it to proceed in a manner consistent with these principles of fairness and due process. And in addition, as I mentioned earlier, as a practical matter, if you fail to observe these principles, your decisions may be at risk of being overturned, or you may be at risk personally for penalties. For most of this commission's history, it wasn't clear commissioners could engage in ex parte communications, but at a minimum, such communications were highly suspect by courts, and courts have traditionally frowned on this sort of contact. On the basis of many California cases, as far back as 1974 for the Coastal Commission until at least 1988, the Attorney General's office consistently advised commissioners to discourage parties from attempting to provide them with information outside of the hearing, or to avoid them entirely, and if they did occur, to disclose them. And more recent judicial pronouncements, including a 2006 California Supreme Court case, suggest that ex parte communications present due process issues. However, in the early 90s, the legislature specifically adopted ex parte rules for this commission, which expressly permit ex parte communications, provided that all such communications are disclosed as required by the statute. Those disclosure... Those disclosure requirements are key for at least three different reasons, and these reasons also give you guidance about how much disclosure occurs. First, they're key to the fairness principles we've been discussing because they ensure that the parties know what you've heard so that there are no hidden facts influencing your decision. If someone disagrees with what you've been told, they have the opportunity to respond and present their own view of the facts. Second, having all the facts that form the basis of your decision on the record so that everyone knows what they are has an additional practical advantage as well. Once ex partes are disclosed, they cease to be ex partes and become part of the record and part of your substantial evidence. If your decisions are challenged, the standard of review requires that there be the substantial evidence in the record, and if evidence is left out, the Attorney General's office is at a disadvantage in defending your decisions. And finally, disclosure is necessary to promote the openness principles in the Coastal Act findings, as these disclosures requirements guarantee that you make your decisions in a manner that ensures the general public is aware of your basis for your actions. And with these principles in mind, the rest of what we'll talk about will focus on the nuts and bolts of the rules that the legislature adopted for the Coastal Commission. The Coastal Act provides its own definition of the phrase ex parte communication. It applies to any oral or written communication if it occurs outside of the official meeting record with an interested person about the matter within the commission's jurisdiction, so that meeting that includes meetings and phone calls as well as documents you receive, email messages, or any other type of communication. It also includes any individualized communications you receive during the hearing. For example, if you receive a call on your cell phone or an email message while you're at the hearing. It does not include communications to schedule an ex parte or procedural matter, or any procedural matter related to the matter, to the hearing item. So if somebody emails you to ask, can we schedule an ex parte, that communication itself is not an ex parte. More definitions. The definition of an interested person. The definition applies to interested persons about matters within the commission's jurisdiction. So knowing what matters are within the commission's jurisdiction is important. You can see that this definition, is very broad and really applies to almost every sort of application for a permit or plan or an amendment that comes before you. If an application has been submitted and you'll be making a quasi-judicial decision on that application, the matter is subject to your jurisdiction. As indicated by the underlined text at the end of this slide, the application has to have been submitted. So until there's one on file, communications about a future matter are technically not ex parte communications. But once the application is on file, even if the hearing hasn't been scheduled and maybe months away, the matter counts. One thing you will notice is not included on this list are enforcement matters. And the AG's office has advised the commissioners are not, that it is not advised to engage in any ex parte communications concerning enforcement matters because of the heightened judicial nature of those proceedings. And additionally, the legislature did not call those out as being matters that ex parte are proper on. The statute also defines three categories of interested persons. These include, first, applicants and other participants in the proceeding, and secondly, people with a financial interest in the matter. Also, it includes agents and employees of each of these two groups. And finally, it includes people representing various interest groups, from neighborhood groups to environmental and civic groups to business groups, regardless of financial interest. Remember as well that these definitions establish the minimum requirements from what must be reported, so if you aren't sure, you may always err on the side of reporting communications with a person who appears to fit this concept, or you can check with us if you have any questions. Exclusions. The statute also excludes certain people from the definition of interested persons for ex parte communication purposes. And this slide shows a list of the types of communications that are specifically excluded. You don't need to worry about communications with your staff or communications about procedural issues. If an interested person contacts you to schedule an ex parte, that is not itself an ex parte. Many of you serve on other state or local bodies, and you can see the communications that you have in your official capacities on those boards, even if they are about matters that will come before this commission, are not ex parte communications. And finally, there are some exclusions for communications by non-voting commissioners. As I mentioned before, the legislator has made clear that ex parte communications are generally allowed, provided you comply with the disclosure requirements. However, they are never mandated. You are not required to take ex parte communications, and no one has a constitutional or statutory right to engage you outside of the official record. You may decline a request for an ex parte meeting, whether on principle or simply because you don't have the available time when it is requested. Someone may ask you for an ex parte communication 10 minutes before the hearing begins, and you simply just don't, or four people may ask you, and there would simply be no possible way to have those, even if you would be otherwise willing to do so, and there is no obligation to try and make that time. In addition, as indicated in the matters within the commission's jurisdiction definition, the allowances for ex parte communications covers a wide range of commission actions, but it does not list enforcement actions. Again, because enforcement proceedings are more like prosecutions, with your staff acting in the role as more like a prosecutor and the alleged violator more like a defendant, the Attorney General's office has advised us that the heightened due process requirements for such hearings may make any ex parte communications inappropriate. Next, I'd like to review the disclosure requirements. As we've indicated above, when you engage in allowable ex parte communications, it's critical that you comply with the disclosure requirements. In order to comply with the statute, in order to protect the integrity of your decision and to provide a complete record of your decision, and even to protect yourselves from personal liability. First, disclosures must be on the record. If the communication occurs more than 7 days in advance of the hearing on the matter that's discussed in the ex parte communication, you have to complete the disclosure form and get it to staff before the meeting begins. This means you shouldn't wait until the item is on the agenda and then disclose it on the mic at the beginning of the hearing. It must be disclosed in writing ahead of time. And once that is done, there's no need to disclose it at the hearing. For example, if at this meeting an interested person approaches you and wants to have an ex parte on a matter for a future hearing, You obviously would not be able to disclose it on the mic at the next meeting because that next meeting is more than 7 days from now. So you would fill out the form and submit it now, and that form will then be attached to the staff report for the public to see and be able to respond to. Then at the next meeting, you can say your ex partes are on file. However, if you have other communications on that item within 7 days of that hearing, then you must disclose those communications on the mic at the hearing. Disclosures must identify who was involved, where and when it occurred, and a complete description of the communication. That last factor is obviously one that is subject to some discretion on your part to determine exactly what you need to say. Clearly, you're not expected to transcribe everything that was said in your conversations. However, you do need to bear in mind that one of the key purposes of the disclosure requirements, in addition to general transparency, is to allow interested parties to understand what you've learned that may be influencing your decision, so that if they have a different perspective, they can then respond during the public comment portion of the hearing. So if someone gives you a thorough explanation about why their project should or should be approved, and you simply say in your ex parte that you talked to someone about the project and they said you should approve it, that's not really complying with the purpose of the statute or with the disclosure requirement of the statute. There has to be enough in your report so that someone can understand what you were told and be able to respond to it if they want to. In addition, this assists your legal team in being able to defend your decisions. If there was information that you relied upon when you made that decision, you should include the substance of it in your disclosure so that we can include it in the substantial evidence in the record. One thing that is not part of a disclosure, however, is your own thought process or comments during an ex parte. Part of what you were doing up until the time you deliberate and make your decision is gathering information and not forming an opinion, but listening to all the information before you so that you can make a decision once all of that has been presented. So your own thought process along the way is incomplete and really is not a proper part of that disclosure. And in addition, you should be sure to send any written communications that you receive ex parte to staff so that staff has a copy and then may also include those in the written record. There is also an additional prohibition in the Coastal Act, which basically says that if you do engage in ex parte communications and you don't disclose them, you can't participate in the decision or attempt to influence other commissioners or the decision. So that's a recusal requirement that's included in the statute. And finally, just a couple of closing points regarding noncompliance with the rules. Failure to comply with the disclosure requirements or the recusal requirement can expose you to potential civil fines and attorney's fees. As you can see, those fines can be up to $7,500 for any individual transgression, and the attorney's fees for whoever brings the complaint may also be awarded. Finally, in terms of protecting the integrity of your decisions, the statute does expressly provide for a party to seek a court order revoking your action if you violate the provisions on ex parte communications. So if there's found to be a violation, the decision that the entire commission reached may be revoked. And that concludes my presentation. This is just a nice picture of a state park I think we'll be going to see shortly. Or drive by, anyway.
Thank you. Ms. Schmelcher, if I could just start with a question. Whether or not there's any exemption for an ex parte with our appointing bodies. I've heard in the past that somehow they are exempt from ex parte, but I don't actually see anything in the presentation. So if you could just clarify that for us.
They are not listed as an interested person in the statute. They are not specifically called out. This would fall into the category of a commissioner may always report, but it is not, the appointing power is not specifically called out in the listed names of appointing of interested persons.
Okay.
And unless they would actually be an interested party because they're the applicant or a financial have a financial.
No, generally they're once removed. Generally the applicant or the representative have gone to the appointing body who, in some cases in the past, have contacted commissioners. So you're saying that would not be covered?
That is not mandatorily covered.
Okay. Any other questions? Commissioner McClure.
Yes, on the serial meeting discussion in relationship to commissioners, I was under the belief that it's okay to talk about issues if we're not trying to find concurrence, if we're trying for information gathering.
If it is information gathering about an item before the commission, that really should be happening on the mic in front of the meeting. I think practically speaking, the way it might come up in a court case would be if there was a decision reached, but that distinction is not identified in the statute. And so discussing a matter amongst a quorum or a majority of commissioners.
No, I'm not talking about, I'm just talking like if I spoke to two, but then you identified and then they spoke to two and then they spoke to two.
Yes.
That it could reach, but without seeking concurrence, but only seeking information.
It's still deliberating, and it's deliberating that would not, that members of the public would not see or understand the commission's deliberation process. So while, again, I think practically speaking, the likelihood would be that it would be challenged. There's a heightened level of risk of challenge when a conclusion is reached. The process of deliberating outside of the eye of the public by a majority of commissioners, even in a serial way, would be a serial meeting.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Mitchell.
Just clarification on that. But if commissioners are talking to each other, we are not putting new information into the record. I mean, we're not giving new information because we don't have any new information other than what was given to us through an ex parte, through the public presentation, et cetera. So I don't understand why that would then be suspect, because we're just talking to each other but not putting in new information to change people's minds.
Well, I think that last part is the part that we can't really say in the abstract. There may not be new information, but obviously you often hear colleagues during the public portion of the meeting take information that was presented publicly and say, and this is why I think this is the most important thing, and this is why I would do X and such. So the fact that they're not introducing, that you're not introducing new information doesn't mean that as part of discussing it with your colleagues, you wouldn't, that any individual commissioner wouldn't be adding their own thought process or analysis or reasons for looking towards one conclusion or another, even if they haven't quite made up their mind, and that may be influencing another commissioner. And if that commissioner then turns around and says, Commissioner X thinks this, and I found that very persuasive, there can be the same kind of deliberation that happens in a serial way.
Commissioner Zimmer.
I have a further question about the prohibition on ex partes in enforcement matters. And it came up for me this last week where we had an enforcement matter that was to be followed by a permit for the same property for the similar issues. And I was asked by both sides to meet, and when I realized that it was enforcement, I declined. Some commissioners did hold meetings on the related permit subsequent. So do you have any guidance on how much of a relationship there needs to be to make the subsequent permitting process suspect under the ex parte rules or dangerous based on that?
Well, again, it's going to be a very fact-specific inquiry and decision on the part of the commissioner, and ex partes are permitted on permit matters. However, when there's an enforcement matter that is related and the facts of the two items are largely the same, it would be my advice that it's very hard to separate out the enforcement matter from the permit matter, and as a matter of caution, avoiding the ex parte would be the most conservative route. However, commissioners do need to use their own discretion and avoid discussing the enforcement matter. But if a commissioner believes it can discuss solely the permit matter, then the commissioner may do so.
But the penalties all fall on us as individuals,
yes,
and not on the person who might have inadvertently induced an inappropriate conversation.
That's correct.
In other words, the lobbyists, the agents, there's nothing in the statute that provides for penalty.
That's
for
correct.
Them. Okay. And then on the serial meeting question, it occurs to me to ask how that relates to the practice that we have, for example, on I think in context of substantial issue on an appeal, we have a practice where three commissioners need to raise objections to avoid a presumption that substantial issue is found. If in reviewing a staff report, I have concerns about the propriety of voting for substantial issue, and I share that concern with two other commissioners to see if there's any support for having a discussion about it, is that a problem in terms of a serial meeting question?
Well, I think it raises the same concern that three commissioners doesn't become a quorum.
Right.
Because of the nature of the matter, the statute is about a majority or a quorum. It does raise the same concern that any other serial meeting concern would be raised, that those other two commissioners may speak to more people, and you may not be aware of that, or even one or both of those other commissioners may not be aware of the subsequent conversations. I understand what you're saying about the three, but at the same time, I think the place for raising those concerns is to ask questions publicly or to seek clarification from staff about questions about the substantial issue.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody down here? Commissioner Mitchell.
So I have a question about site visits and the limit on only two commissioners, because I understand if there were a quorum of commissioners going on a site visit, but the fact that only two commissioners can go on a site visit, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, that has become, I think, a matter of practice about subcommittees, and there has been a general practice of only having two or three commissioners on a subcommittee, and that you have more than that. There's that you have basically a subcommittee without it being designated by the commission. So I think that has been the concern, but it is not a hard and fast rule.
Okay, because if it's not a designated subcommittee, I mean, I could see if the chair created a subcommittee and then that subcommittee, you know, did something together and took an action and made a recommendation. But if, you know, three people want to share a car to go on a site visit because we're all going to have to drive to Long Beach or wherever, it seems to me like there isn't any reason that couldn't happen. Three or four or five, for that matter, six.
I think that generally that could happen. The larger the group, again, the more likely you are to, especially if you're visiting a site that's a matter within the commission's jurisdiction or that's likely to come before the commission, you're then running the risk of a serial meeting issue. But
we can take tours, and as long as we don't have a quorum or a serial meeting. So.
Well, yes.
A follow-up question to that. So if an applicant or an environmental group seeks out contact with all 12 of us, which happens frequently, and they take us two by two on a boat tour, and they reach all of us at one point or another, how does that not become a serial meeting?
Again, this is, presumably this is an ex parte communication that each of the commissioners will disclose, and then they will become part of the record. But the commissioners, again, need to avoid discussing substantively the item with one another or reaching some sort of conclusion or consensus with the interested party who's reaching out to each of you, so that that person isn't saying, well, I've got an agreement, you know, I've taken everybody two by two to this site, and each of them separately agreed that the site meets this criteria or that criteria, and none of you would know that anyone else had done that. But
so if we don't know it's been, then do we have a problem or don't we? I mean, we're...
Well,
we're,
I think this is where reaching conclusions becomes more important. If you're speaking with each other, there's the risk of people introducing analysis and argument that's not in front of the commission.
Right.
If it's more akin to an ex parte, that's a situation where you should be receiving information and then disclosing it, and that becomes part of the regular record, and that is, that's again specifically allowed under your rules.
And I would just add, I think if you treat the that kind of a site visit as fact finding, you're out there to receive information, and then it's an ex parte and you disclose it, then that's okay. And that's valuable to visit a site.
What you have are, you have two different statutes here that were not written with one another in mind. So we are meshing the two together. You have the Bagley-Keene
right.
Open Meeting Act, which is saying don't have serial meetings, and then you're having, you have the Coastal Act, which says you may engage in ex partes provided that you follow these rules. So we are overlapping the two to mesh them together in the best way we can. And I think Charles's suggestion that we treat that as fact-finding, and I think that's what I was trying to suggest in saying that you go and you take in the information, but you don't discuss it amongst yourselves and then reach some sort of conclusion is the way to approach that.
But the penalties for having a serial meeting flow to the commission as a whole, not to the individual commissioner, is that right? Whereas the penalties for ex parte are for are ours as
no,
individuals.
I'm not sure that's
correct. I mean, if a meeting
actually. I believe they're each individual.
They're both in. So we're at risk as
yes.
individuals in both cases.
I believe that's correct.
I know exactly.
Okay.
Charles, in closing, I'm sorry to do this to you on the spot, but we talked about this a day or so ago, and you had a list of questions that you would advise commissioners to ask either the person asking for an ex parte or to ask themselves before they make the decision to have an ex parte. Mm-hmm. And if that's close to the front of your brain, would you run through that list of questions? Because I found it very helpful myself. I often don't know the answer to them unless I actually ask the person who wants an ex parte.
Sure. And I think these were embedded in Hope's presentation along the way that, the first thing to remember is that you're not obligated to have an ex parte, so you can manage your time. And if you don't want to do it, you don't have to. But if somebody asks you, I think the best way to manage the risk related to that potential communication is to ask the person who's contacting you, one, are you involved in any litigation? Is this a matter of litigation with the commission, yes or no? If they say yes, then best not to proceed. And then second, same question, is this a matter of enforcement in front of the commission? And if yes, best not to proceed. And if you just have that at the outset, ask whoever's contacting you those questions, and then that can help you decide whether to have the communication. And then if you're uncertain, you could contact us to confirm. There's so many things pending, it's difficult for you and us to have an active list of what you should and should not be talking about.
Right. If I may add one bit of clarification to Commissioner Zimmer's question, under Bagley-Keene and the serial meeting provision, The Act provides for misdemeanor penalties against individual members. If the member attends a meeting in violation of the Act with the intent to deprive the public of information to which he or she knows or has reason to know the public's entitled to receive. So there is an intent component to that. However, the penalty is individual. There is the ability for the prevailing party to recover attorney's fees, and that actually flows back to the commission, not the individual. But the misdemeanor penalty is attached individually.
Commissioner Norvell.
Yes, occasionally I get ex partes that come in writing. Pretty rare for me as a non-voting member because it doesn't really benefit them at all. But it comes in through a agency, and they get sent over to me in my department, often after the meeting. So it really doesn't have any opportunity to even influence me. So do I report that, or can I just trash can those, or how does it work?
If it's after the meeting and an action has been taken at the meeting, it wasn't continued, the item's no longer before the commission.
Okay. What if it came in a day before? I don't even have time to read it.
But if you haven't seen it, then it's not okay. Something you can disclose. However, if it's something in writing and you do receive it before the meeting, the easiest thing to do is to forward that to staff. If it's within 7 days, you still need to disclose on the mic that you received it. But once you disclose it to staff, staff will make it available on the web, the writing, and attach it to an addendum, so it will be public as well.
Okay, thank you. In closing, I guess I'll just say from my point of view, and I would urge my other commissioners to think of it the same way, is that when in doubt, I always try and err on the side of the public and making sure that whatever I decide to do in an ex parte or in talking with other commissioners or whatever, that I'm in no way kind of jeopardizing full participation and knowledge of the public on any action that we would take. So that's my other guidance as well as Charles's questions. So with that, I think we can go on to access.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Before Linda gets started here on item 5 specifically, I did want to make a few framing comments. And many of you probably know that we are coming up to the 40th year anniversary of our program, the Coastal Program. And Proposition 20 was November 1972. Soon thereafter, February 1973, we started issuing permits under Prop 20. And then, of course, 4 years later was the Coastal Act. So the program has been around a long time, 40 years. During that time, we've accomplished much. We've ranging from protection of the public's right of access to the coast, protecting sensitive wetlands and coastal habitats, as well as concentrating development in already developed areas while protecting, you know, amazing rural coastal landscapes up and down the coast. And, of course, we know that the coastal program enjoys wide support from Californians, and that you are charged with protecting not only a statewide resource, but a resource of national, if not international, significance. Looking the other direction, along our coast, about 80% of the coast is covered by certified LCPs. And so local governments have been and remain an integral and critical part of successful implementation of the coastal program. But in anticipation of our 40th anniversary that's on the horizon here, staff is going to be undertaking an effort to bring to you and the public at our meetings over the next year, every month, little stories or presentations, short stories about aspects of our program, successes, accomplishments, in an effort to both acknowledge and celebrate the coastal program as we head towards that 40th year. We will try to focus on stories and issues related to the area we are meeting in. And through that, we hope to facilitate an exciting and educational public conversation about the coastal program, its accomplishments, and our challenges ahead. So today, in that spirit of launching that focus, we have Linda Lachlan here from our public access program. You know, one of the great benefits we have in our program is staff up and down the coast who've been here 20, 25, if not 30 years, and have a great history in our program, and we can capture that now and begin to tell you those stories so that we can approach our 40th year with both a sense of what we've accomplished and also what lies ahead. So she's going to talk about public access, and it's very timely, this report, and it relates directly to much of what you're going to see later today in the field trip. So I'll pass it to Linda now.
Thank you, Charles. First of all, before we get going, I wanted to mention to the commissioners and to the members of the public that I did hand out to the commissioners a copy of the vertical access report this morning. It was not mailed to you because of the expensive color copying. So you each have a copy in front of you. I'm presuming you already had a chance to look at the copy, of course, that was in the e-packet, as well as I handed out a copy of a map to the Orange County beaches. So for members of the public, there are copies of this report for viewing out on the desk. If you want your own, you'll have to print your own. It's we just beyond our ability to print color copies for everybody. So I wanted to start with, before we get into the actual content of this report, which again evaluates the Coastal Commission required vertical access ways and the status of them, meaning are they opened or are they closed, and a number of other factors, I wanted to just give you an overview of the access program activities. It's rare that I have the opportunity to present to you, so I wanted to spend about 5 or 10 minutes going over the access program and then another 10 minutes in the report. So bear with me as we go through this. And this is a very heavy graphic presentation. It's a little bit different than the last presentation you had. But let me start with this first slide, which is the Coastal Access logo. This is a logo adopted in 1980. It's the official State of California logo adopted by the Coastal Commission and the Coastal Conservancy as a point of our joint access program, which I'll talk a little bit more about the access program in a minute. But this logo, you'll see it in the report, and you'll see it many times on our field trip today. So I just wanted to point it out, and for the members of the public, too. It's commonly called the foot and wave logo, and what that is at the top is the three C's of the California Coastal Commission and the wave with the footprints below it. So whenever you see this symbol, you know that if you follow that sign, you should get to the coast. And I also want to point out that these signs that are put up along the highway or the coastal highways in the highway right-of-way are put up by Caltrans per an agreement we have with them from 1980. It's an MOU. So Caltrans pays for the installation of those signs and the replacement should they ever fall down. So the first thing I wanted to bring up, everything I'm going to show you today is on the Commission's website. So for anybody that wants more information, you can find all of this on the website. Back in 1999, the Commission, we prepared a public access action plan, and this was pursuant to an initiative by then Governor Wilson for a coastal initiative to prioritize for the state of California the coastal resources. So we prepared this public access action plan. It's over 100 pages long, and it's a blueprint for where the access program for the Coastal Commission should be going in the near and long term. The report includes our access priorities, and I just bring out the top three, which was the first one, which is the subject of most of what we're going to talk about today, is implementation of the OTD program. I think you all know that OTD stands for Offers to Dedicate Public Access Easements. Those are conditions imposed by the Commission upon permit applicants to mitigate the impacts of private development upon public access. Two other priorities in the action plan are completion of the California Coastal Trail, as well as protection of prescriptive rights. Going back to the implementation of the OTD program and the reason that we're here today to talk to you about the vertical OTDs, and the vertical easements are the ones that are perpendicular to the shoreline, and they get you from the road down to the beach. And when they're opened, they provide meaningful new access points to the general public. And one of the main recommendations in the action plan, and there were over 100 recommendations contained in the plan, was the prioritization of the vertical easements and be sure that each and every one that's feasible be opened in the future. So this is why we're talking to you today about the vertical OTDs. The cumulative impacts of the public access are also discussed in the action plan. You can see those up there. You deal with them every month on, you know, through permits, planning, LCPs. When we go out in the field today and do our field trip, you're going to see examples of issues from shoreline armoring when you're at Broad Beach, encroachments in the public right-of-way when we're at Lachuza, You heard yesterday the continuing issues about beach curfews. We all know about poor water quality and beach closures, the issues with state parks and their closing parks, as well as one issue that wasn't so so clear in 1998 was sea level rise. Another component of the action plan, one of the recommendations was that the commission continue to and increase our public outreach to the general public to inform them of what their public rights are, how to get to the coast, and what they can do when they get there. So there's a number of publications. Again, these are all on our website. Many of these are available for purchase. And let me just briefly go through them. The California Coastal Access Guide covers the entire state coastal of California. It has 850 sites. Every legal public access way is included in this book. We've updated it several times. It's a very popular seller. We initiated a regional Experience the California Coast series in 2005, and we've done three out of the four books. The fourth one is coming out soon. So I hope that most people here in the audience have at least purchased one of these books. They're very, very good. Another thing on our website are graphics that show you where the lateral easements are on two beaches in Malibu, both of which we're going to today. The Broad Beach, there's been ongoing controversy about the lateral easements, the dry sandy area in front of the homes, where the public can and can't go. So to assist the public and deal with this controversy, we've created these graphics, posted them on our website. They're heavily used. And one thing I would like to point out is looking at this picture here of Broad Beach. This is quite a few years old. When you go out there today, it's not going to look quite so broad. So keep this picture in mind. Again, this is a part of the Broad Beach graphics. You can see it's quite a long beach. It's about a mile and a half long. There are two public access ways to the beach. And this is a close-up of just a portion of one of those pages. You can see on the right-hand side that footprint symbol, the coastal access symbol, that shows the lateral easement operated by Los Angeles County, and then all those blue lines with the words are showing you where all the laterals are that the commission has obtained through the permitting process, and those are the areas that are very specifically open and available to the public. I do want to point out that this particular accessway here at Broad Beach is operated by Los Angeles County, and it predates the Coastal Act. So this is not covered in the report on the vertical accessways in the sense it was not an OTD, not required by the commission. We did a similar graphic, again, on our website for Carbon Beach, and this will be the last stop on your field trip today. We're looking at another stretch of a beach that's about a mile and a half long for assistance. Take a look to your left. You see that's the Malibu Pier. So we will be visiting this beach, and we will be stopping at this accessway that was opened in 2005. Again, look for the coastal access symbol there on the right-hand side of the slide. The colors on the sandy beach area shows the different laterals that have been obtained through your permitting process. And we call this accessway Carbon Beach East. The permittee was Geffen, but the actual name of the accessway is Carbon Beach East. A local nonprofit was inspired by the challenge of the locals trying to find the beaches in Malibu, and using the information in our access guides, prepared their own simple handout map called the Malibu Beaches Public Beaches Map. It's on our website. It's done by the Los Angeles Urban Rangers, and they also did a Spanish version. So they're both on our website, and they're free to download. Another map that's on our website is this one, the Orange County Beach Access Guide. That's the one that I handed out this morning. This was produced with funds from an oil spill mitigation. Going back to the action plan, the second issue, priority area was completion of the California Coastal Trail, and I won't be talking about that today, but I wanted to point out that there is a publication that was jointly produced by the Coastal Commission and the Coastal Conservancy on objectives and goals and the status of the California Coastal Trail. I guess I would just say in brief that about 60% of the trail is complete at this time. So now I'm going to move into the second half of the presentation, which is very specifically discussing the status of the vertical accessways that the commission has required through your permit actions over the last 40 years. just to start off with a little bit of definition, like what is a vertical access way? As I said, it's an easement that goes perpendicular from the road to the sea, and they come in all different forms. On the right-hand side of the slide, you see a stairway going down to a beach. That's an example of a vertical easement. On the left-hand side of the slide, on the top, you see a group of homes, and you see, if you can see it, it's a street-end stairway. On the bottom, you see a zigzag stairway going across a bluff face at a state park. These are all types of vertical access ways. One other kind of type of vertical access way would be a viewpoint on the top of a bluff. This is a summary of what we found when we analyzed the 111 vertical easements that have been required in the first six counties which are covered by this report. So this is a series, one in a series. We haven't had a chance to move all the way up the coast, but starting in San Diego, going through San Luis Obispo, the green are the ones that are open. The red have yet to be opened. So you can see San Diego County is the highest opened rate. Orange County comes next. And then there's some challenges in the next four counties, and I think you can see for yourself which ones those are. Then the question becomes, well, who manages these access ways? Last month, you had a presentation from the land use, statewide land use planning unit was talking to you about open space conservation OTDs offers to dedicate and the status of those. In the case of the open space easements, once they're accepted, the mitigation is complete in the sense that all the steps have been taken. It's different for the public access easements. Once the OTD is accepted, the easement is secured, but that does not mean that the next day the access easement is open for public use. There's a very big step left for the staff to do, which is to find and work with local partners for someone to take on the steps to operate, build, and manage and take on the liability for each one of these access ways. This is a huge challenge, and that's why when you look at the chart that I just showed, why there's so many that still haven't been opened, is there's a lot of difficulties, and I know a lot of you work with your various government agencies. You know that there's all sorts of challenges from liability, from construction costs, from staffing costs. So here's the breakdown. Of course, I was fascinated when I saw this, when I did my own statistics, and I said, well, who are all those private landowners operating 38% of our public access ways in these six counties? Well, those private landowners, the definition of those is resorts, condominium complexes, and two very big trails in San Luis Obispo County by PG&E. Otherwise, as you can see from this pie chart, local government is by far the biggest operator, and that's what the commission had always anticipated way back when we started this program in the late 70s of requiring OTDs. And then we have a number of state agencies that help us. So this is just to acknowledge our partners here in these six counties. We have a state government. The two agencies that are responsible is the Coastal Commission is the regulatory body, but with our partner through the Joint Access Program, the Coastal Conservancy provides significant help through technical assistance, grants to local government for construction, and other opportunities that they can provide, including being the, by law, the agency as a last resort if an OTD is about to expire. So together, through an amendment to the Coastal Act in 1980, the Coastal Commission and Coastal Conservancy worked together jointly to implement the policies of maximizing access to the coast. Our other state partners are, of course, State Parks, State Lands Commission, the Santa Monica Mountains Conservancy, and MRCA. And you will see one access way today that's operated by MRCA, which is Carbon Beach East. We're going to see Lachuza, too. You're right. Thank you for that. I was focusing only on the vertical easements required by the Coastal Commission, and the easements at Lachuza Beach were not required by the Coastal Commission. I want to acknowledge the six county governments that the report covers these six counties because each one of them play very important roles. And within each county, there are a variety of cities, and I apologize to all the cities who may be watching this or those of you that represent cities. I couldn't put everybody's logo on here because it would be too much, but it's very important that we recognize that our work cannot be completed without our local government partners. We also have nonprofits play significant roles, and in these six counties, we have two nonprofits that are providing vertical access by opening and operating two of our required vertical easements. One group is the Agua Hedionda Lagoon Foundation, the City of Carlsbad, and Orange County Coastkeeper in Huntington Beach. And we definitely want to thank them for their help. And again, they have been given assistance from the State Coastal Conservancy. Then getting to the actual graphics in the report, this is a very heavy graphic report that's very much a summary of what is going on. Behind these graphics, I've done extensive research on every single one of these OTDs, and there's much more than shown in the report. This is just a summary. So to portray to the, when you're reading the book, where this report, where all the easements are, we use the graphics from our experience, the California Coast series. Then we took the pages from the book that show where all the legal access ways are, and on top of that, we added where the Coastal Commission vertical easements are. Now, if they're shown in green, they're open. If they're shown in red, they haven't yet been opened. This particular slide I find very interesting because this shows that in, I'm sorry, I can't read it. Is this Carlsbad? Yeah, in the city of Carlsbad, if you looked in our book, our regional experience, the California Coast Guidebook, you would see that there's seven vertical accessways in the city in this location. When you look at the overlay of these sites, these four San Diego sites, you would see that four of the seven in the city of Carlsbad on this page were required by the Coastal Commission. So that's very significant. And this is the first time that we've been able to really quantify which of the open accessways that you might have been going to for 20 years were actually required by the Coastal Commission through a permit condition. This is another slide in San Diego. This shows what a condominium complex managing entity, how they, you know, in that pie chart where I showed that I said private associate or private groups that are operating accessways. And number 17 here on the right is a condominium complex that the Coastal Commission approved and required the condominium complex owners to develop two vertical access points, which are the two arrows on either side, and then a blufftop trail to connect those two. So that's open and operated for the public every single day. Moving up the coast, I just picked one example from every county. You can see this is a large resort. There's those green lines are all the public trail systems. There's public parking, public bathrooms, public access down to the beach. And this is all operated at the expense of the resort for the general public. Where is that? Montage Resort in Orange County. So here we are in Los Angeles at Trump. Again, another large, big development approved by the commission with extensive public access requirements. And all those zigzaggy green lines all represent all the trail systems, public parking, public bathrooms, public signage, access down to the beach. A different kind of requirement here in Ventura County is in the Channel Islands Harbor. The black dots, I'm not sure if you can see them, but you can see them on your own screen, you know, outlines the definition of the project site. And the caption tells you what was approved. In this case, it was more than several hundred homes were approved by two different permits. And there was a requirement for public access all the way around this large residential subdivision area. And there's a public park on the upper left. Viewpoints, that's what VP stands for. So you can see all the development the commission required. In addition, all the public access that was required in this case, it's open and available to the public. Moving up a little bit further, we hit Santa Barbara County, and this is the Bacara Resort. So we approved this large resort hotel. Again, on the right-hand side, there's a public parking lot. There's that green line, which is a trail down to the beach. There's public restrooms down there, the beach itself, and a blufftop trail. Then the last county we cover in this report goes up to San Luis Obispo, and PG&E owns a large section of the California coast around the Diablo power plant. Through two different permits, we obtained two three-mile-long trails, blufftop trails. This is the one, the northern one, that directly comes off of Montana de Oro, goes down 3 miles. This is built and operated by PG&E for the general public. Here's the southern trail, the Pecho Coast Trail, comes directly from Port San Luis, and again, operated by PG&E for the benefit of the public. Then I wanted to just highlight one last one here in the city of Pismo Beach, where on the left is a resort hotel, The Cliffs, and on the right is a much older hotel called Spyglass. In between, you can see a third resort and with just dashed green lines. And what that shows is the Coastal Commission required the resorts on either end with the public access requirements for the Blufftop Trail and the access down to the beach. And then after the LCP was certified, the city came forward, developed that hotel in the middle, and as part of their permitting process required the lateral. So there's a string of laterals that all make for a very nice long promenade. But so I wanted to emphasize that this report only looks at Coastal Commission required easements, not locally required. So if you're looking in this report and trying to find some project you know of, and where is it, we're looking at Coastal Commission in this. This is a small subset.
This slide also is an opportunity to point out another action you took at the Cliffs Hotel to protect access. There was a revetment placed during the storm year. It was ultimately determined to be a violation and was ordered to be removed by the Coastal Commission, and so there is no revetment on the beach there where there was for a while, but also protecting public access.
So now I'm just going to move into the last section of this report. I wanted to specifically focus a little bit on Los Angeles, Malibu, because that's where the field trip is going in a little bit. So here we are with the cover page to Los Angeles County. This is central Malibu, city of Malibu area. I like to call this page the map of opportunities. We have a lot of vertical easements required by the Coastal Commission. Most of them, as you can see, are not open. If we had all day, I could explain to you the status of each one of those and why they're not open and what steps we're taking to get them opened or what we need to do to make them come open. But let's just say that this is what we have. Today, we're going to stop at number 21. Is that it? I'm sorry, I can't quite. Yes, number 21 on the right. That's the green one. Again, that's Carbon Beach East. That'll be the last stop on the field trip. So this is what Carbon Beach East looks like when you're driving along PCH. There's just a wall of development. You can't tell. All you know is for a mile and a half, it's just a solid wall. If you're a visitor to this area, if you're not familiar, you would have no idea there's a beach on the other side of these wall of development. So this is, gates are closed. You have no idea that there's a beach on the other side. If you could by somehow get to the other side, say you came off the, you went swimming or you had a kayak or a speedboat or helicopter, whatever, this is the beach directly on the other side. It's this beautiful, white, sandy, carbon beach, mile and a half long. This is the amount of public access that you would see before the accessway was opened. Then in 2005, working with our local government, our local partner, Access for All and State Coastal Conservancy, the easement was opened up to the public. So this is what it looks like, and again, you're going to be walking down this later today. Yes, the Permittee Geffen. We give the name Carbon Beach East.
I know we would want to name it.
So at the end of the accessway, there's a little ramp to deal with seasonal fluctuation change in the sand. And this is what it looks like on a weekend when you go there now. There's all sorts of people enjoying the beach, doing your typical beach-type activities. And we're very proud of this achievement. At this point, the management has been transferred over to MRCA, Mountains Recreation Conservation Authority, and you'll be meeting them on the field trip too. So that's the last slide of the presentation. And the next steps are, like, what are we going to do from here? Well, there's two things that we're doing in the Access Program. One is we will continue this research marching up the coast. You know, we have 9 more counties to do the analysis of the vertical easements to figure out the status. And then at the same time, we're looking at all of the closed easements and trying to identify the steps, or I have identified many steps, but find the partners we need to make these different easements open up. So that's it. So if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you. That was great. Yeah. What a great way to kick off kind of our celebration of 40 years. That's really something.
I think it's clear from Linda's report what, an accomplishments the agency has had and the incredible accessways that are out there. And as I mentioned, Linda has been with us from virtually the beginning, 1977.
Well, why don't we just say 36 years?
Okay, 30. She knows what's happened.
Great job. Thank you. Are there any questions? Yes, Commissioner Bochco.
I noticed on the map the Dan Blocker or Block Beach, and there was just an article in the LA Times about that, how it's been closed for 17 years or long time, 20 years. I just wonder, are we in any way involved with that issue? We are.
We are, and Jack's happy to talk to you about it on the field trip.
Fabulous. Okay, thank you.
We are going to stop by it, right, or drive by it anyway. Any other question? Seeing Commissioner Zimmer.
I would just like to request at some point a summary of the coastal trail status, because I know there's a lot of interest, particularly around the Gaviota Coast area, to be moving forward.
Sure. We'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
So we do have a field trip scheduled, and I'm hopeful that the buses are outside. Yeah, the bus is outside. And that's an inside joke for those of you who weren't here a year or so ago.
Where the buses didn't show up.
And we're a little behind schedule, about 10 minutes behind schedule for departure. So if you could take just a few minutes to get ready and get on the bus, that would be great.
And could I just say one more thing? If for those of you that don't need the printouts of the report or the map that I handed out today, please either leave them on your desk or return them to me, because staff can use those. If you want them, please keep them. But
I also want to mention to the public, if they want to attend the field trip, they're welcome to follow along behind the commission bus and also join us at any stops that we have.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'd like to call the California Coastal Commission back to order and begin by thanking staff very much for putting together, I think, a really informative field trip. It was enjoyable. It's a lovely day, and we were on the beach, and who doesn't love that? But more importantly, it is just seeing things firsthand and actually being there gives a much, much better feeling than any overhead you could possibly show for us. And being in this area, and we've had so many projects in the past and those coming forward, it was, at least for me and what I've heard from other commissioners, it was time well spent. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you. We agree. It's always good to get out and see things. And I definitely want to thank Jack and Pat and Linda and Lisa and Steve for doing all that work on the narration and figuring out the logistics.
Worked very well. Thank you. So now we'll go back to the agenda, and we're to the North Coast, I believe.
That's right, Madam Chair. There's an administrative permit application from the North Coast, which is an application. This is item 6A, by the way, which is an application of Robert and Catherine Figas to remove and dispose of debris that had been previously placed on a parcel in King Salmon in Humboldt County. We're aware of no opposition or controversy surrounding this item, and we'd recommend that the commission concur with the executive director's determination to grant the administrative permit. If four or more commissioners request, the application would be removed from the administrative calendar and set for a public hearing at a subsequent meeting.
Thank you. Is there any unwillingness for unanimous concurrence? Seeing none, we concur.
And that takes us to the energy and federal consistency portion of the agenda today. First item of business today is I have a de minimis waiver to report to you that was distributed to you yesterday.
I have minor items.
Oh. I jumped the gun.
We did have some minor items to report under Central Coast, and I'm not aware of any objections to those items under the DD's report. That's item number 9.
Any unwillingness for unanimous concurrence? Seeing none, we concur.
Same on the Energy Deputy Director report. We've received no objection to the issuance of this waiver, so we seek your concurrence.
Any unwillingness for unanimous concurrence? Seeing none, we concur.
And that takes us to item 13A of the agenda. This is a proposal by Santa Barbara County to amend the coastal zoning ordinance portion of its certified LCP to add a definition for an oil and gas drilling method called hydraulic fracturing To clarify that hydraulic fracturing is not a permitted use in oil and gas exploration, and to clarify that hydraulic fracturing in oil and gas production, whether from an existing or a new well, is subject to environmental review, a public hearing, and county review in the form of a production plan and a coastal development permit. Hydraulic fracturing is also referred to as fracking, and it's a drilling method that involves blasting water, sand, and chemicals at high pressure into deep formations to stimulate the flow of oil and gas. This isn't a new practice, but it's one that's become more common recently, especially in the natural gas business. There's a lot of concern over its environmental effects and the lack of regulatory oversight. Last year, Santa Barbara County learned after the fact that a producer had conducted hydraulic fracturing on existing wells inland of the coastal zone, and the permits for these wells did not authorize this method of drilling. So in the amendment before you today, add specific language that hydraulic fracturing is not a permitted use for exploration. For production, new language is added that if fracking is to be conducted, whether from an existing or new well, the activity must be described in an amended or a new production plan and a coastal development permit. The executive director has determined that the proposed amendments are minor because the changes add clarity to permitted uses for oil and gas development that are currently in the coastal zoning ordinance, do not change the kind, location, intensity, or density of use, and are consistent with Santa Barbara County Certified Land Use Plan. The notice for this amendment was circulated to interested parties for 10 days. We've received no objections to its approval. If the commission concurs in this determination, the proposed amendments would take effect automatically, immediately. If one-third of the commission disagrees, we would then proceed to process it as a major amendment and bring this back to you at a future meeting. This concludes my presentation.
Thank you. I have no speaker slips. Commissioner Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to defer to Commissioner Zimmer.
We do have speaker slips. I'm sorry.
Oh, hold up. You're next. Yeah.
Let me just ask staff, usually with concurrence, this doesn't happen. I go ahead and take speaker slip and back to the commission and we do a, or do I have to ask for four or more? What is the process going forward?
I think you can take the public testimony on the matter.
Yes. Okay.
We would advise that.
It's an item
that.
On the agenda that we
right,
can take.
Right, right. But when we come back, do I have, never mind. Okay. So first of all, are there any ex partes on this? Seeing none, Toppin Hugh, I'm afraid I can't read your writing, so put your name on the record for me.
I believe you're speaking. My name is Tupper Hall. I am Vice President of Communications. Is that better?
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners. My name is Tupper Hall. I am Vice President of Communications for the Western States Petroleum Association. Our association represents the major integrated oil companies that do business in the western United States, including as well as the independent producers and refiners. We're not here today to ask or to oppose this action, nor did we oppose the action, the adoption of the amendments to the Santa Barbara County Ordinance. We do, however, want to take the opportunity and appreciate the opportunity to put into the record our very strong view that we believe hydraulic fracturing, as employed in California, is a safe practice. It is an effective way to increase the efficiency of producing domestic resources. As your staff indicated, as far as we've been able to determine, hydraulic fracturing has been used in California for well over 40 years, and to our knowledge, and we don't believe the record indicates there's ever been an indication of environmental harm or harm to the citizens of California as a result of this practice. We are very well aware that there are concerns about the types of chemicals that are being used in the hydraulic fracturing process, and for that reason we've worked very closely with Assemblyman Mikowski on an Assembly Bill 591. Unfortunately, that legislation did not get out of the legislature in 2011. We're very hopeful it will get out early in 2012. We're working very closely with Assemblyman Mikowski and the sponsors of that bill, the Environmental Working Group, and hope that early in 2012 there will be a requirement that companies submit to the state and the state makes public a database of every well that's subjected to hydraulic fracturing and a complete list of all of the chemical constituents that are in that material. That, I believe, or we believe, and the indication we've had, that's the principal concern that's been raised with hydraulic fracturing. And with that, I appreciate again the opportunity to address you and happy to answer questions if you have any.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything staff to add? All right, I'll come back to the commission. Commissioner Zimmer.
Thank you. First of all, I want to commend our staff for bringing this to the commission so promptly. I understand that it came to them only in December. I think this is a very important clarification that we need, especially in Santa Barbara County, which has been an oil-producing county, both offshore and onshore. I'm happy to hear that it's possible that in the future the state will adopt legislation that does require disclosure of the chemicals that are used in this process, because that is one of the major concerns that people have. But in the meantime, I'm very happy that the Santa Barbara Coastal Zoning Ordinance will now contain specific provision for environmental review and disclosure of those chemical constituents. So, again, thank you to staff and commending the County of Santa Barbara for their work as well.
Thank you. Commissioner Sanchez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to state that I agree with the Executive Director's determination that this that the proposed LCP amendment qualifies as a minor amendment.
Is there any unwillingness for your unanimous concurrence? Seeing none, we concur. Thank you.
And that takes us to item 14A. This provides recommended findings for the Commission's objection last month to the Corps of Engineers' consistency determination for conducting geophysical and geotechnical tests on Santa Rosa Beach in Cambria. The Corps proposed conducting those tests in support of a desalination facility it plans to build on behalf of the Cambria Community Services District, or CCSD. You received an addendum yesterday that includes correspondence and some additions and corrections to the proposed findings. Now, last month, the Commission found that the Corps' proposal was not consistent to the maximum extent practicable with the enforceable policies of California's Coastal Management Program. The findings before you, we believe, provide the reasons that the Commission gave for determining that those tests would be inconsistent with Coastal Act policies related to protecting marine life, sensitive habitat, and public access, as well as policies related to preventing spills and reducing risk to geologic hazards. The Commission also raised questions last month about whether the CCSD should have applied for a permit, either in lieu of the Corps providing a consistency determination or in addition to a consistency determination. These specific studies were authorized by federal legislation and federal funding. We spoke to the Corps and CCSD and were informed that the Corps is solely responsible for contracting and carrying out the development associated with the proposed studies, and this is reflected in their contracts. The Corps submittal of a consistency determination, therefore, did require the Commission's concurrence or objection within 75 days, or your concurrence would have been presumed. Since the Corps has legal responsibility for implementing those studies, and under these circumstances, the CCSD is not undertaking any development in the coastal zone as part of these studies, we believe in this case that we couldn't require a coastal development permit. Now, we do believe differently, though, for the desal facility that's contemplated for this area in the future. For that desal facility, the CCSD must obtain a coastal development permit, which is required by their LCP. That LCP says that they need to get a CDP for any major water supply project for Cambria. Additionally, even if the Corps were to build the facility, the project agreement between the Corps and CCSD specifies that CCSD would be responsible for operating that facility, and as such would be continuing to do activities such as withdrawal and discharge of seawater, which constitutes development. And we therefore added language in the addendum that any subsequent proposal for a desal facility would require a coastal development permit. The motion and resolution to adopt the revised findings are on page 20 of the staff report. Please note that only the commissioners that were at the December hearing and on the prevailing side of the vote are eligible to vote on these revised findings, and those commissioners are listed on page 1 and on page 20 of the staff report. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you. I have no... All right, I have no speaker slips, so ex partes. We're on 14. Okay. No problem. That's fine. Are there any ex partes? Looking to my right? Left? Seeing none, I will open the public hearing and call Michael Tone.
Well, I see that you have basically, you seem to have gotten to my concerns about the desalinization problem. I think that Southern California, the aquifers are not very extensive, and they can be drawn down very rapidly in conjunction with the climate change that's going on. The rate of water coming down into that, in the ocean floor and the land right there, is changing because of various factors. I don't even know if those were put into consideration by the Army Corps of Engineers. I imagine would have to do basically what the Coastal Commission was asking them to do, as long as it was within the realm of federal law. But there are other factors involved there. Groundwater withdrawal on the shoreland also, the lack of the water coming down because of the climate change and less water, et cetera. What you're doing, the possibility is it's upsetting a natural flow that's already, it's already been upset, and there's no integration of that back to the ideal position, which would be, well, we're going to return to the natural flow sooner or later if we quit melting down the ice cap, et cetera. So anyway, looks like you've got a good tack on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Connor Everett. Connor? All right. So with that, I will close the public hearing. Staff has nothing to add. Come back to the commission. Commissioner Zimmer? No? Commissioner Zimmer?
Thank you. I wanted to thank staff for the additional information and for the language in the addendum that clarifies, from my perspective, what will happen. And I know other commissioners raised the same issues with respect to requiring a CDP. And I just wanted to be clear back at you that any desal plant is going to require a CDP. And I also expect that in future applications for testing systems, that each one of those will be a case-by-case factual determination as to exactly the relationship. So thank you.
Commissioner Sanchez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the Commission adopt the revised findings in support of the Commission's action on December 9th, 2011, concerning the Corps of Engineers Consistency Determination CD-047-11 for its proposed geophysical and geotechnical studies at Santa Rosa Beach in Cambria, and recommend a yes vote.
Second. It's been moved by Commissioner Sanchez and seconded by Commissioner Bochco. Would you like to speak to your motion?
Just brief.
Could you speak directly into the mic, please? They're not picking it up in the back. Okay, thank you.
Okay, just briefly, I want to state that for the record that I believe staff embodied the include all the bases for our findings, and I know how that our decision had to be based on specific findings, and staff listened to everything that we said that were very specific and relevant to the decision, and I thank you.
Commissioner Bochco, would you like to speak to your second?
Only to concur with Commissioner Sanchez's comments.
All right. All those on the prevailing side who agree, who want to vote yes on this, please raise your hand.
Nine zero.
Thank you very much. The revised findings are found.
That brings us to the North Coast District portion of the agenda. And the first item 15, is the Deputy Director's Report. We distributed last night and this morning a pink addendum, the Deputy Director's Report, which does contain one immaterial permit amendment for your consideration. This involves improvements to the Target store in Eureka. We're aware of no opposition to this project, and we've received no comments to date. So we recommend that the Commission concur with the Executive Director's determination to grant the immaterial permit amendment.
Thank you. Any unwillingness for unanimous concurrence? Seeing none, we concur.
There is no consent calendar for North Coast, and item 17A, the Delnard County LCP amendment, was postponed earlier. So that brings us over to item 17B, which involves concurrence with the Executive Director's determination that the action of Delnard County accepting Commission certification of LCP Amendment DNC MAJ-1-10 is legally adequate. The Commission acted on this amendment back in June of 2011. The proposed amendment as submitted amended the county's land use plan to allow limited extension of community water supply and sewer lines along Humboldt Road beyond the urban services boundary to serve the relocation site for the Elk Valley Rancheria's casino and hotel development. The Commission rejected the amendment as submitted, but certified the proposed amendment with one modification. The county has adopted the necessary resolutions in late November to accept and implement the suggested modification, and we've reviewed that resolution and believe it's legally adequate, and we are recommending that the Commission concur with this determination. If the Commission does concur, once the staff files the requisite notice with the Secretary of Resources, the amendment will become effective.
Thank you. Any unwillingness for unanimous concurrence? Seeing none, we concur.
Then item 18A is the application 1-11-17, the Easy Landing RV Park and Marina. This is an application of Naeem and Louise Obiji, who are doing business as the Easy Landing RV Park, to improve their existing recreational vehicle and mobile home park by demolishing and replacing an 1,800-square-foot building housing a caretaker's quarters, office, and store, and replacing it with a 2,000-square-foot double-wide mobile home that would house the same uses, as well as authorizing after the fact the 2003 demolition of a 750-square-foot workshop building and installing similarly a new double-wide mobile home to replace the workshop in the historic footprint of these demolished buildings. And this is all at the Easy Landing Trailer Park off of King Salmon in Humboldt Bay. The trailer park, as I mentioned, is in Easy Landing King Salmon, which there we go. I was looking for the pointer, which is just opposite the mouth of Humboldt Bay. So the point of this is to show that it's not on the bay proper. The next view is an aerial view looking down at King Salmon and the project site. And you can see the majority of the King Salmon is a residential development. It's on old filled baylands. Most of the uses are residential, except you do have the Easy Landing Park, the combination mobile home and RV park, with access onto Fisherman's Channel, which has direct access out to the bay and later on out to the ocean. The trailer park is comprised of 31 mobile home installations and 45 short-term RV spaces, as well as the 70-slip marina, which is in disrepair but is still usable. The property is zoned commercial recreation with a flood hazard area combining zone. RV parks and improvements to boating facilities are all conditional permitted uses in that zone. The mobile home park is considered by the county to be a legal nonconforming use. Slide 4 shows the specific project area, and it shows the two mobile homes structures that will be replacing the two buildings to be demolished. Again, these aren't supporting residences. It's supporting support uses for the park facility itself, the workshop, store, office, etc. Staff is recommending approval with special conditions. The primary issue raised is priority uses. And, of course, the Coastal Act establishes numerous provisions for the protection and reservation of waterfront sites and areas for the development of facilities for a variety of high-priority coastal-dependent, coastal-related, and visitor-serving uses. As noted, the site does support some of these uses. The RV park is a visitor-serving use, a lower-cost visitor-serving use, and the marina supports recreational boating. The project does not involve any changes to this mix of uses at the site. And so, therefore, we believe that the project is consistent with the Coastal Act policies for continuing these uses to ensure that there are not future changes to the structures being authorized or to the surrounding area that might increase residential use or some other use at the expense of priority uses. Staff's recommending special condition number 16 or 6, which is a future development condition, which would require that any change of use, including use of these structures as actual mobile home residences to be rented out, would require an amendment to the permit, where the commission would have the opportunity to review the balance of priority uses on the site. With regard to other issues, the applicants are not proposing any activities that would result in fill of the coastal area. The site is already disturbed. The staff is recommending a special condition requiring the implementation of best management practices to guard against water quality impacts. So before I conclude, I need to make one small correction to the staff report. The headings of the report at the top of page 1 incorrectly list the filing date as June 14th of 2011. The filing date is actually September 8th of 2011. In conclusion, we believe the project as conditioned is fully consistent with the Chapter 3 policies of the Coastal Act, and we recommend that the Commission approve the project as conditioned by adopting the written staff recommendation. And the motion can be found on pages 3 and 4 of the report.
Thank you. I have no speaker slips. So do I have any ex partes? Seeing none, the will of the commission. That's been moved by Commissioner McClure, seconded by Commissioner Brennan. Would you like to speak to your motion? Commissioner Brennan, are any unwillingness for unanimous yes vote? Seeing none, we deem it unanimously approved. Thank you.
And that brings us to item 19A, which is a request by Antonio Savoca to extend a permit granted for a two-story, 24-foot-high, 4,239-square-foot single-family residence with a garage, driveway, septic system, and water storage tank located along Coast Highway 1 south north of Anchor Bay along the southern Mendocino coast. The site is generally halfway between the communities of Point Arena and Wallala at the extreme southern end. This is an aerial photo of the surrounding area, which gives you a sense of the rural nature of it, although there are a number of lots. It's zoned rural residential, so generally you have residences on 2 to 5 acre lots, essentially. This is a photo from the Coastal Records Project outlining the particular parcel involved. This two-acre site is, as you can see, is relatively flat and forested before it comes to a steep coastal bluff. The frontage along the bluff and the ocean is approximately 95 feet, and the depth of the lot is about 400 feet from Highway 1, which goes along the back side. Staff recommends that the extension not be granted because changed circumstances exist that affect the development's consistency with the natural resource policies of the certified local coastal program. The standard conditions attached to all of your coastal permits provide that an approved permit will expire 2 years from the date of approval unless an extension is made prior to the expiration date or unless the applicant vests the project in the meantime. Permit extensions can be granted annually. In its consideration of coastal development permit extension requests, the executive director must determine that there are changed circumstances that affect the consistency of the development with the certified LCP and the public access policies of the Coastal Act and report that determination to the commission. In cases such as this, where the staff has determined that due to changed circumstances, the proposed development may not be consistent with the policies of the certified LCP, Section 13169D of the regulations provide that the commission will hold a hearing at which it will accept testimony and then determine whether there are changed circumstances that affect the consistency of the project with the standard of review. Pursuant to that regulation, if three or more commissioners determine that there are changed circumstances that affect consistency with the LCP and the Coastal Act policies on public access, the extension request shall be denied and the application shall be set for a full hearing at a subsequent meeting as though it were a brand new application. If no such determination is made by three commissioners, i.e. no change circumstances are found, the permit would be extended for an additional 1 year period. In this case, the applicant was granted an administrative permit for the development back in 1983. No development has commenced since that permit was approved. And since that time, the permit has been extended a total of 24 times. Each year, the commission staff visited the site prior to issuance of the permit extensions to determine whether there were changed circumstances. In each of the previous years, staff has determined that there were no changed circumstances, and the commission concurred in those determinations, annually granting the extension. What's different? Well, with the current extension, staff visited the site and discovered what appear to be occurrences of a rare plant species growing near the northwest portion of the property in the immediate vicinity of the bluff area and also in the vicinity of the approved house in a location that does not provide for a requisite 50-foot buffer, which is the minimum buffer required by the Mendocino County LCP. The plant that was observed is a coastal bluff morning glory, Calistegia purpurata saxicola, but it has close cousins, so to be sure that in fact it was the rare species, we asked the applicant to provide additional botanical information to verify whether it indeed is the rare plant. The subsequent botanical information that was submitted by the applicant's consultant verified that this is the rare plant. The coastal bluff morning glory has a California rare plant rank of 1B.2, which means that it's considered rare, threatened, or endangered in California and elsewhere, even though it's not listed as an endangered species on either a state or federal list. Because of this relative rarity at the state level, it meets the rarity test for designation as ESHA under the Coastal Act. When the commission granted the permit back in 1983, this plant was not listed as a rare plant, and so there was no indication that the development would be constrained due to sensitive botanical resources. The plant was listed in January of 2001, and since that time, the Coastal Bluff Morning Glory has popped up in a number of permit applications reviewed by the commission, and the commission has consistently determined that occurrences of the plant are incidences of environmentally sensitive habitat. In addition to the coastal bluff morning glory occurrence, the botanical information that the consultant provided revealed that the site also contains an additional botanical resource that has been determined to constitute ESHA in the years since the original coastal development permit was granted. The botanical information indicates that the forested parcel is forested predominantly with northern bishop pine, which is not a rare species in and of itself, but the bishop pine community alliance, the vegetation community type, is treated as rare. And it is considered to be vulnerable and at moderate risk of extinction at the global and state levels, and highly imperiled and of high priority for inventory in the California Natural Diversity Database. Further, the northern bishop pine forest has suffered extensively, particularly in Mendocino County, from pitch pine canker and needle blight, and has become increasingly threatened and imperiled in its existence. The northern bishop pine forest has been recognized by Mendocino County in recent years as ESHA, as also the commission has recognized it in a number of appeals that have come forward to the commission in the last few years. The particular coastal morning glory plants that were observed are located, as I say, we believe within 50 feet of the development site itself. And although the botanical information that was submitted did not include a map superimposing the development over the area where the sensitive habitat and its buffer are determined to be by the botanist, we created these side-by-side images so that you can observe. This is the approved house on the left here of slide number 6. or number seven, rather, and on the right is the botanical information. The occurrences are shown near the bluff edge and to the left and right sides of the parcels. The line back from those is a 50-foot buffer, and comparing the two, it seems clear that the development site is certainly within 50 feet, if not directly displacing the plant. And as noted before, the northern Bishop Pine Forest appears to extend over the entire property, and therefore would be affected by the development as well. This is the in slide 8. This is the LCP policy that sets the buffer requirements. Basically, it requires that a 100-foot buffer be established between development and sensitive habitat, although it does allow that after consultation with Fish and Game and analysis based on certain criteria in the LCP, that the buffer can be reduced to a minimum of 50 feet. But as noted, even so, with the 50 feet, the development appears to encroach into that area. So looking ahead, if the commission were to find today that changed circumstances exist and deny the request, the application, the 1983 application, would be reheard by the commission at a subsequent hearing. The commission's regulations indicate that the applicant may be required to present additional information necessary to evaluate the effects of changed circumstances. And on page 18, or beginning on page 18 of the staff report, we identify a number of items of information that we believe would be important in that evaluation, primarily more complete botanical information surveying the entire site, as well as an alternatives analysis that would look at alternatives that could possibly, if not eliminate impacts with ESHA and encroachment into buffers, at least minimize the impacts to the sensitive habitats. We'd also note that we are asking for information which, if the ESHA was determined to extend over the entire parcel such that there are no alternatives that would completely comply with LCP policies, that we're asking for information to determine whether a denial of the project would result in a regulatory takings. Staff would expect that there's a good chance that the applicant could show denial would result in a takings, but we need to evaluate the information. If a takings were to result from a denial, the commission would need to approve a development on the site, but not necessarily the particular development approved in 1983. It could be smaller, it could be in a different location where if it doesn't miss all the Bishop Pine, perhaps it could avoid the rare plant Morning Glory and its buffer. In conclusion, staff's determined that there are changed circumstances that affect the consistency of the development with the policies of the Mendocino County Local Coastal Program, and we're recommending that the extension not be granted. As I noted before, the commission will need to open the hearing and accept any testimony before voting on the request. And pursuant to the regulations of the commission, if three or more commissioners determine there are changed circumstances, then the extension would be denied and the application would be set for the full hearing. The motion to adopt the staff recommendation can be found on page 2. And that concludes my remarks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any ex partes?
Seeing none, Commissioner Zimmer.
Madam Chair, thank you. I have a procedural question on this. As I'm understanding this, in 83, the county did not have a certified LCP, but in the intervening years, it does now have a fully certified LCP.
That's correct.
So what I'm not understanding is if we find changed circumstances exist, which would not authorize an additional extension, why wouldn't this go back to the county for a new CDP application?
Well, and staff counsel may want to chime in, but the regulations provide that an application that or permit that's been approved by the commission, the extensions and amendments are handled by the commission, and conversely, when a situation like this arises, the regulations provide for review by the commission of the application after changed circumstances are found, if indeed they are.
So I guess I'm waiting to hear if council has anything to say.
Yes. It's
the decision about changed circumstances is your decision. If there were changed circumstances and the applicant ended up wanting to apply for a new permit, that would go to the local government.
Okay.
Your review would be pursuant to the LCP regardless.
Yeah, if I'm assuming it's in the appeals jurisdiction, so still. Okay, thank you. So I would move that we find change not allowed to.
I'm afraid you can't speak yet. Okay. Commissioner Bochco.
I'd like to move that the commission find that there are changed circumstances that affect the consistency of the development approved in the Coastal Development Permit number 183158 with the policies of the Certified Mendocino County Local Coastal Program.
It has been moved by Commissioner Bochco and seconded by Commissioner Zimmer. Would you like to speak to your motion?
Only to say that, it's apparent there have been changed circumstances in the last 30 years, and I think a review would be most appropriate.
Commissioner Zimmer, your second?
Agreed.
All right. All in favor of the motion, please raise your hand. There are...
It's unanimous.
Unanimous, and many more than the required three, so changed circumstances have been found. And Dr. Lester, I believe that takes us... Oh, no, sorry, I have
to
one.
To public comment.
I have... Yes. I have one public comment. Dan Gottlieb. Yes.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Daniel H. Gottlieb, Professor Emeritus of Mathematics. I intend to draw on that expertise in this talk. 1 year ago, last November, in this very room, a video was presented showing a parking ticket ambush of guests of a three-hour affair at the community room of Chase Park in Marina Del Rey. Parking was paid for by inserting quarters in a parking meters at the adjacent parking parcel. The meters accepted only quarters for every 10 minutes of time. No other coins were permitted. The guests scrambled around collecting 18 quarters to park for 3 hours. But parking was legal only for 2 hours, so the guests received tickets anyway. Those of you at that meeting will recall a county official tried to show how easy it was to pay into a parking machine. It took him about 10 minutes to succeed, and then he turns to the camera and says, "So you see how transparent it is." Very entertaining. I want to discuss the mathematics of this event. I will use the unusable coins. I will call the unusable coins view pennies and the usable coins view corridors of quarters. Thus, 25 view pennies can add up to the value of a view quarter, but they cannot be used. Only view corridors are specified as being legal. The Marina Del Rey LCP states that a view corridor shall be a minimum of 20% of the parcel. View pennies or their sums are not mentioned or defined in the LCP. Doing a mathematical procedure incorrectly in the past is not an precedent for doing it incorrectly in the future. Some cases may be too difficult or unsuitable to apply the mathematics, but that's no excuse for not applying it correctly in the simple cases. The possibility of adding 25 view pennies to get a better result than one view corridor should be addressed by changing the law in an open and fair way, not by changing the English language or misleading judicial, quasi-judicial bodies. Incorrect mathematics is always a substantial issue for an appeal. For these reasons, please revoke the permits of Parcel 2110, Parcel FF, and any other project on a rectangular parcel using view pennies on the grounds of fraud. Please do not do this for your own self-respect without a formal application of revocation. Another question is, how could the staff make such an error? It seems to me that 11 out of 12 commissioners must have received illegal ex partes. The county is an applicant, and county lawyers are obligated to defend the developers. The CCC staff must have had sophisticated misinformation campaign from the county lawyers and their developing allies.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay.
Michael Tone?
That sounds nice, but it is just Tony. At least I suppose I could change it, huh? Would that be legal? Number 11, I wanted to talk, and you didn't get the speaker's request there. But in terms of the oil and gasoline, offshore oil and gas, et cetera, Melville mentioned the Indonesia earthquake in about 2004. A cubic mile of natural gas had been extracted directly over the earthquake area, and then it seemed to have collapsed and triggered this huge earthquake. We have Chile and Japanese quake, and the other one, which there was two in South America, one in Japan. These are huge earthquakes. There is incontrovertible evidence that the North Polar Cap has been melting down. Sit for 19 years from a NASA satellite study that was done analyzed in conjunction with Navy submarine measurements done under the North Polar ice cap. It's absolutely unequivocal. So there has been this, and then there is the resultant tidal changes, larger tidal changes in conjunction with the gas and oil extraction. You've got a weakening of the ocean floor, and it looks like there's not really analysis been done about that, but I know the Indonesia one is on point to that cause. So, and of course, these are all thermodynamics, just as nuclear power is thermodynamics, and you're looking at bigger kinds of destructions coming on. I don't agree with the statement that was made by the person representing the oil extraction companies about fracking, et cetera. I have studied a lot of engineering and mathematics, et cetera, and it just doesn't make sense that you can weaken the ocean floor by busting it and then allow the flow to come. The pressure increases. Also, there was the Deep Horizon well, which happened. So you have the oil and gas extraction that is also creating the thermodynamic heating that is part of this problem too. So just wanted to pass that at. Pretty bad, all the thermodynamic stuff. They don't know what they're going to do yet. And thanks for the time.
Thank you. Connor Everts.
Thank you very much, Connor Everts, Southern California Watershed Alliance and the DSAL Response Group. Welcome to Santa Monica, and I'm glad you all had the tour. I was here this morning, and I guess I missed my item, but I just wanted to thank you for the findings and the Cambria decision. It's been a long time coming, but I think we're seeing that there are other solutions than industrializing the coast. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And with that, I would also like to thank Commissioner Mitchell for being a very, very gracious hostess last night to the commission and senior staff. And it was a grand meal, a grand venue. It was really quite a lovely evening. So thank you very, very much for that. I'd also like to thank Pam O'Connor for hosting us in your lovely city with the beautiful weather. And this is a great venue for a meeting. So thank you very much. And glad you joined us today. Thank you. And I believe, Dr. Lester, are we?
Yep, I think we're done.
Is he in Santa Cruz?
Next month is Santa Cruz, yep.
All right. Thank you very much. Travel safely, all of you.